Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Asian American and Asian Research Institute's Friday Lecture Series virtual edition. We're honored to have here with us Dr. John Chin from Hunter College to present to us today on illicit massage parlors in Los Angeles County and New York City, stories from women workers. This report is together with Hunter College and the University of Southern California, and it aims to shed light on the experiences of Chinese and Korean immigrant women working in illicit massage parlors in LA and New York City. Dr. Chin is a professor of urban policy and planning at Hunter College, State University of New York, and he's also the director of Hunter College's graduate program in urban planning. His research has been focused on the role of community institutions in the delivery of social and health services and communities of color. Professor Chin is also interested in how key community-based institutions in immigrant and minority communities shape community values and norms, particularly in relation to controversial or sensitive topics like HIV and AIDS. Prior to his academic and research career, he actually helped found the Asian and Pacific Islander Coalition on HIV and AIDS, federally qualified health center known as APICHA, Community Health Center, where he served as deputy executive director. And without further ado, Dr. John Chin.
Well, thank you so much, Anthony. Really glad to be here. Thank you for having me. So I'm going to focus today on labor exploitation, stigma, and social isolation of Chinese and Korean immigrant women working in illicit massage parlors. And as Anthony mentioned, we're focusing on Los Angeles County and New York City. So just if you want to download the full report, you can copy this link and you can download it online. All right, so just a little bit about the study. So this study occurred from 2013 to 2016 and was supported by the National Institute of Child Health and Human Development, which is an institute of the NIH. It was done jointly with Lois Takahashi, who's a professor at the University of Southern California. And just a disclaimer that the content is solely the responsibility of the authors and does not necessarily represent the official views of the NIH. All right, so just a little bit of background before we jump into the data. So sex work in LA and New York City has increasingly moved from the streets into indoor venues, such as massage parlors, which is the focus of this study, but also hotels and bars and private residences. And this is due in part because of heightened enforcement of anti-prostitution ordinances, which has made highly visible sex work on the street more difficult. And also the internet, which has made finding female sex workers and the venues where they work more easily located by male clients. So recent national media coverage of illicit massage parlors where sexual services are provided have, you know, made the headlines recently. So there was the story in the New York Times about the sex worker who committed suicide. And then there was one that was specifically on massage parlors that made a lot of press in Jupiter, Florida, that got a lot of coverage. And what we're finding is that the media coverage has often focused on prostitution and human trafficking rings, and that police crackdowns are often spurred by community complaints. But we don't really hear about the sort of day-to-day experiences of the massage parlor workers. So we had three areas that we wanted to explore in the study. So a labor perspective, what are the experiences of Asian women working in sexually oriented massage parlors in New York City? So how do they enter the work? What are the social and economic factors that drive them into the work? What are their day-to-day work experiences, and what is the impact of criminalization and social stigma on their experiences? And then a health angle. So obviously this is an NIH study, so there's a health angle to it. And so it was an HIV specifically focused study. So we want to know, what are HIV and other health risks for Asian women working in sexually oriented massage parlors? And then finally, thinking about recommendations and solutions for the issues that we're seeing. So just to give you a sense of the distribution of massage parlors, I'll focus some of our slides on New York City and some looking both at LA and New York City. So this is the five boroughs of New York City. And as you can see, the dark gray areas and black areas, those are the high concentrations of Asians by census tract. And you can see there's a pretty good correlation between the location of massage parlors and large concentrations of Asian communities. So we see them in Manhattan, up and down the west and east sides of Manhattan, and then in the financial district in Chinatown, in Brooklyn, we see them in Flushing and the Elmhurst areas, but also, I'm sorry, in Queens, the Flushing and Elmhurst areas, but also, you know, throughout the borough of Queens. We see the Brooklyn Chinatown here, some massage parlors in that area, but also in other parts of Brooklyn as well. So how did we do this work? So we interviewed 116 Chinese and Korean massage parlor workers who provided sexual services. We had 62 in New York City and 54 in LA County. And these interviews took place between October 2014 and July 16th. Just a little bit about working with a vulnerable population. So we did provide a cash incentive that was approved by our Human Subjects Research Board. And this was important because, you know, the women in the studies, they found that, you know, participating in an interview like this was actually, or they conceived of it as lost income for them. It was time they could have been making money. We also used a verbal consent process so they wouldn't have to sign anything. And we also had a certificate of confidentiality for the study, meaning that we wouldn't be able to be subpoenaed by law enforcement to turn over research records, which was important in this situation where the work they're doing is criminalized. All right, so just to give a little bit of background on the women. Oh, I should have mentioned in this slide here the number of massage parlors that we found. So we used a ratings website. So there are websites that rate massage, sexually oriented massage parlors, just like Yelp does for restaurants. So we used a company called rubmaps.com, a website called rubmaps.com. And we searched for massage parlors that had active reviews within a 1 year period. And we searched specifically for Chinese, Korean, and Asian massage parlors, which made up more than 90% of the massage parlors in the at the website. And so we found 475 massage parlors in New York City and a similar amount in Los Angeles County. All right. So let me tell you a little bit about the 116 women in the study, and then I'll move on to talking about some of the issues they're facing around healthcare and experiences with law enforcement. Okay, so how old were the women in the study, and when did they first start providing sexual services in any massage parlor? So the median age of women participating in the study in New York was 47 and 43 in LA County. And the age when the women started providing sexual services was 43 in New York City and 40 in Los Angeles County. And the age range of age at time of starting sex work in a massage parlor, it ranged from 20 to 62. So, you know, it's a fairly, you know, older population that we're seeing in the massage parlors, not a sort of 20s or teens population. It is an adult women population for the most part. That's not to say there aren't other aspects of the sex work industry that are targeted more towards younger and underage women and girls. It's just that we're not seeing it as much in the massage parlor environment. All right, so let's look at the education level of the participants in the study. So you can see in Los Angeles County, 20% had less than 8 years of education. It's a little bit lower in New York City, but 14% had less than 8 years of education or had greater than 8 years, but not a high school grad or GED diploma. And you can see the greenish and the yellow color is a four-year college degree or beyond. So it's a very small portion, 7% in New York City that have a college degree or beyond, and 9% in LA County with a college degree and none with a graduate school education. So primary language of the participants. So we specifically recruited Korean and Chinese women. So it should be about half and half. We had a little bit more trouble in Los Angeles recruiting Korean women. So we have 36% speaking Korean in LA, 55% Mandarin, 2% English, and a little bit of a larger percent speaking Cantonese. And it's a little bit more half and half between Korean and Chinese speaking in New York City. So English proficiency is a major issue in terms of why women work in massage parlors. Their English proficiency is relatively low. So 9% in LA County and 18% in New York City say they don't speak English at all. And if you look at the pie here, it's a good three quarters or more of the women in both places who say they don't speak English at all or not very well. And only 6% in New York City and 4% in LA County say they speak English very well. So this clearly limits job options in the United States. So what is the marital or domestic partner status of the women? So you can see about a quarter in each place was never married or single. But we do have this orange is divorce, so a fairly large number of divorced women. Married women, 21% in LA. This is married and living with the spouse, and 6% in New York City. New York City seems to have a larger proportion of married but not living with the spouse. Do the women have children and do they live with their children? So in New York City, 17% are living with their children and 27% living with their children in Los Angeles County. And then a lot of women, the red, have children but are not living with them. So a very large proportion of the population that we're studying, they're mothers. Okay, so let's delve into the interview data. So I'm going to present some quotes to you. The quotes are actually the verbatim transcription of the interviewer's notes. So we did have permission from our Human Subjects Review Board to record the interviews, but very few women allowed us to record the interviews because of such a sensitive situation they're in. So most of the quotations you'll see are the notes of the interviewers. All right, so why do women enter the work? So pretty much number one is financial need. So we saw a wide variety of financial situations the women were in. So paying off debts to smugglers in the range of $30,000, supporting parents and children in their home countries, paying college tuition for children in the U.S., and one woman talked about repaying her father's gambling debt. So a wide range of situations. So one of the aspects of this work is that it's very easy to drop into and earn money pretty quickly. So if you don't have any connections or job skills or English language skills and you're undocumented, this is a way that you can survive after arriving in the U.S. So one woman talked about arriving in the U.S. with no money for rent or food. She responded to an ad in the World Journal And she started working that very day, earning $200 to $300 that day. So a lot of women find jobs through ads in ethnic newspapers. There's also chat rooms and online sites where women find work. So we wanted to look at this question of coercion. So the FBI definition of sex trafficking includes force, fraud, or coercion. So we're not going to use that formal FBI definition because it doesn't really help us understand, I think, the nuances of the situations that these women face. But we're sort of drawing a little bit on that definition. So in a few cases, we did find sustained extreme coercion. This was fairly rare, but it was it did exist in our data set. So I'm just going to give you a long example of one of them, pretty much the most extreme case that we found. So in this case, it was a Chinese woman, apparently undocumented. She entered the work in 2014, and she's remained in the work on and off since then. So she says that she came to the United States through a snakehead. She paid $30,000 to come. So Snakehead is an immigration smuggler. When she came here, she was eager to find a job, and she saw an ad in the supermarket bulletin board looking to hire a massage worker. She called a telephone number, and a man picked up the telephone. He said he's hiring massage workers and needed her to come to work the next day, and asked her to show up at a place in Flushing to be picked up. So she followed his directions. She went to that place, and she got into a van. The van drove around for 2 hours and dropped her off. So she said she later figured out she was in a hotel room in Connecticut. The guy who talked to her on the phone came to greet her. He then took her passport, which is a frequent method that traffickers use to restrict the movement of the people that they're trafficking. Later, he locked her in a hotel room and demanded her to provide sexual services. And all the money she made was confiscated by him. And she was given 3 packs of instant noodles a day for food. She was shut in that hotel room for 1 week. A week later, there was a big sporting event that I guess the trafficker was hoping that, you know, would make them a lot of money with clients. But nobody came for services. He released her. She ran back to New York. The next day, she started working in a nail salon. However, that didn't last too long because she was allergic to the nail polish, and she had to quit after 2 months. She quit the job. She got introduced to a different massage parlor, a different sex work situation in a massage parlor. She said she thought she was just going to provide regular service. However, she was getting very little money, just getting a $10 tip for a regular massage. And the owners advised that if she wants to get more tips, that she should provide hand jobs. And she needed the money. She wanted to pay back the snakehead as soon as possible. So she started providing a hand job to the clients after working in the massage parlor for 2 months. So just I gave that long story because it really illustrates the difficulty that the women face in finding other work. So this was a very extreme situation. This, I wouldn't say, characterizes the situation of most women in the study. But even in her very extreme situation, she still went back to sex work because it was really hard to find other options for making some money. All right, so that was a sort of a story of sustained force. She was actually held against her will for a week. What we're finding on the next level of the continuum is more episodic or one-time force, fraud, or coercion. Some cases, they can be relatively mild, relatively speaking. So in this case, in the first bullet, after refusing to provide sexual services, the worker was insulted by the manager in front of other workers for being Korean Chinese. So kind of using an ethnic insult to coerce her into providing sex services. And then another case, the massage parlor owner changed the business type without asking and then forced the worker to provide a hand job to a client, but she still decided to stay with the massage parlor. Then there's maybe another level, which is the threat of termination or not being assigned to clients if you don't provide sexual services. So a threat that you'll lose your job. And I put this on a different level because, you know, it implies that there is some choice here, that the person can quit the job. They're not being held against their will. Then another level is coercion from clients. This generally took the form of a customer grabbing the worker's hand and putting it on his groin area to kind of signal he wanted a hand job, but sometimes it was a little bit more forceful than that. And then the majority of the stories was a situation of more voluntary entry into the work with no coercion. So one woman said that she came here to travel by visa and stay for several months in the United States and worked in massage parlors to get some quick money. This person said she worked only when she needed money on special days, including Christmas, Korean Thanksgiving, or New Year's Eve. It was easy to get work and she made a lot of money in a short time. Participant talked about workers having more power than owners. So the owners can't make money on their own. The workers have their own regular clients. And so if they move to another massage parlor, the clients follow them. So just to summarize about the entry into work, here are some statistics. So 85% in New York City say they weren't coerced. This is according to their own definition. If you just ask them, were you coerced into the work? 85% said no. In LA, it's a little bit different, 66%, but if you add in the client coercion, that's 81%. So very close if you look at these two combined categories between New York City and LA. And then a bit of a threat of termination experienced by the women. A smaller group with one-time force or fraud, and then the very sustained extreme force, fraud, coercion is 3% and 4%. So what we're finding really is that the story of entering the work is that the women find it's the best of highly constrained options. So I would say there are very few women in our study who would have chosen this if they had other options. But because of limited English proficiency, undocumented immigration status, they have very few other options for work. A number of women talked about trying restaurant work and nail salon work, but they found the work more physically demanding, toxic chemicals in nail salons and difficult bosses. And then coupling that with very low wages compared to massage parlor work, it became sort of not viable for them to stay in that work when they had the massage parlor option. So another indicator of, how much coercion's involved, they talk about the reasons for changing massage parlors, and many women talk about it in a way that makes it seem very easy for them to change massage parlors if they don't like the situation in their current massage parlor. So they talked about changing because of treatment by the boss, not liking the cleanliness of the massage parlor, the length of their commute. And they talked about restrictive house rules like prohibiting cell phone use or talking amongst the staff as reasons for leaving that massage parlor and starting at a new massage parlor. There were also economic reasons. So if a massage parlor failed to attract a sufficient volume of clients, they might leave. If they found the boss was keeping the highest tipping clients for herself, oftentimes the boss was a massage parlor worker herself. And then if the clients themselves were demanding or poorly tipping. Okay, so then further about this question of choice, we asked the question, did you start providing sexual services by choice or by necessity or a little of both? So a quarter in LA County said by choice, a smaller percentage, 14% said by choice in New York City. Most women said a little bit of both necessity and choice. Okay, so weekly work hours. So the mean average work hours was 65.6 hours per week in New York City, 59.4 in LA County. And the maximum that we found reported was 144 hours in New York City and 140 hours in LA County. So I think in those cases with a lot of hours, these are women who are actually living in the massage parlor. So what was the relationship with employers like? In some cases, the relationship was quite exploitative. So the owners exploited women's undocumented immigration status, using the threat of calling immigration authorities to coerce them into providing sexual services, stealing their wages, imposing lower wages. They also verbally abused workers and sometimes even physically or sexually assaulted the workers. So one important issue is violence at work. And so we asked, you know, has a client in the past 12 months hit you or physically hurt you? 18% said yes, but only one person reported to the police. This is an analysis just for New York City. Has a client in the past 12 months threatened you with physical violence? 23% said yes, only two people reported to the police. So we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but the women are very reluctant to engage with the police. Has a client in the past 12 months forced you to have sex? 37%, which is, you know, pretty concerning, the high percentage, and only one person reported to the police. So the violence at work ranged from, you know, clients grabbing their hand and placing it on him so that she would provide a hand job. But it could get more extreme, a client choking a massage parlor worker when she refused to provide extra services. And then a client who displayed a gun to force her to comply with his requests. This participant reported that one of her coworkers was being raped while the management did nothing to intervene. The boss was scared. She shut the door because the guy had a gun. The coworker said she didn't tell anybody because it makes her feel shameful. So this person talked about being sexually assaulted by a customer, and then she did call the police, but then she dropped the charges or refused to go forward with the charges because she was afraid the defendant's lawyer would say that she seduced the defendant to have sex and that she felt it might jeopardize her green card application. So there's sort of dual criminalized situation of working in a criminalized profession and then often being undocumented, put them in a really vulnerable situation where they just didn't want to have any engagement with the law enforcement system. Also, the experiences with arrest made them very reluctant to further engage with law enforcement. So the women complained that there was an unfair focus on arresting workers rather than owners. They experienced wrongful arrest, entrapment, and also a police misconduct. So one woman talked about being groped, including touching her breasts, and then upon agreeing to provide sexual services, she was arrested. And in this case, the woman talked about actually regularly providing sexual services to a police officer. She said she knows it was a police officer because when he took his clothes off, she sees the gun and the police badge. And she actually thought what she was doing was not illegal because these were cops and they weren't arresting her until later, I guess. And she also says they were not generous when it comes to tips, and some of them did not pay any tip at all, but she can't say anything because they're cops. So here was a very negative experience with an arrest that a woman reported. She was in handcuffs. She said her heart started hurting. They had to take her to the hospital. And even in the hospital, they were still yelling at her and used abusive language. She still has trauma from the experience. She has nightmares, and she wakes up in a pool of sweat in the middle of the night. And this person said that massage parlors don't feel safe to her because of the police, and she's not afraid of the customers. She feels more in control with the customers. If the customers don't look right, she doesn't let them into the parlor. So she's more afraid of the police, which is something that many of the women talked about. There was also a perception that in some cases that the police were corrupt. So one woman talked about getting donation papers 2 to 3 times from the police. She didn't really know what kind of donation, but she gave them money for her safety. So there are also language barriers in the law enforcement experience. So she says after she finished providing regular massage service, she said it wasn't a sexual massage, that the undercover officer asked her many questions in English. She didn't understand, so she kept nodding, and suddenly around 7 or 8, police broke the door. She was arrested and sent to the precinct, and a public defender told her that she was accused of prostitution. So one of the things that happens in New York City and a very similar program in LA is the specialized courts for prostitution. In New York State, they're called human trafficking intervention courts, but more formally the AP8 courts. And so most prostitution cases go to these courts, and upon completion of mandatory classes, if the defendant hasn't been arrested again, the charges are dismissed after 6 months or less. So this is, I think, in recognition that the women are often victims, and so this is kind of trying to honor that. So one participant described the mandatory classes positively, saying that they're all free. There were 5 classes, taking 8 hours to finish, and then she went to court 2 times, and the court process took her 2 months to finish, and then her charges were dismissed. Some advocates are against these courts. They feel that they only help at the tail end and don't really address police misconduct or the fact that the women shouldn't be being arrested in the first place. And this social service provider talks about some language barriers in these courts. So she says that one time they couldn't find a Mandarin interpreter, and the judge decided that her agency could interpret for these clients in the absence of a court interpreter. But that caused some confusion. And then in some cases, the court interpreter talks very fast for each case with legal terms that the clients don't understand. Also, sometimes the clients might arrive at the court before the interpreter, and then they just have no idea what's going on until the interpreter arrives. So another issue for the massage parlor workers is the stigma and shame around the work. So this participant says that massage work is known as prostitution in her community, and even nail technicians look down on massage workers. So sort of she's saying we're the lowest of the low. And then one participant said that her church was a rumor mill and that church members treated her like a case of infectious disease. So an institution that often is seen as providing social support and connection in this case made her feel worse and more stigmatized. So we're seeing this in the data as well in terms of how many women disclose sex work. So have you ever told a family member about your sex work? Less than 10% in New York City, less than 5% in LA County. So these women are highly, highly isolated. The most they're talking to are close friends, the second bar in each on each side. And often those are also massage parlor workers. So the question, have you sought supportive services from government or community organizations? So the blue is no. So overwhelmingly, these women are not engaged in the social services system in their areas. Okay, so a little bit about the risk for HIV and other sexually transmitted infections. So one issue is, being in situations where they can't use condoms. So in the first case on the slide, the owner forced the young massage workers to provide full sexual service, meaning vaginal sex, for $40 without a condom. In the second case, this woman said she was almost raped. And she got, a post-exposure prophylactic medication in the ER to protect her from getting HIV infection. So about 30%+ of the women reported providing vaginal sexual services in New York City, and then a little bit more than 40% reported that in LA County. This may be underreported because there is stigma around this and also fear around admitting prostitution. So do women use condoms? Looks a little bit less consistent in New York City. So always is this green. So less than 60% say always in New York City and more than 90% say always in LA County. Does the management provide condoms? So 68% say never in New York City and 60% say never in LA County. So that's a problem if the management doesn't provide condoms. Does the management allow workers to use condoms? So this is a little bit better. So never is 36% in New York City and 43% is never in LA County. So at least more than half are saying that they're at least sometimes or rarely allowed to use condoms. So another question is health insurance coverage. So the red is yes in terms of having health insurance coverage. So about 60% of women in both places say they have health insurance coverage. I'm not sure where that's coming from. In some cases, it could be Medicaid if they have sufficient documentation. It might also be Child Health Plus for mothers. So even if the mother's undocumented, the child could be covered and she could have some coverage through that. Have you had a gynecological exam in the past 12 months? More than 60% said yes in both places. So that seems pretty good. I mean, 40% not having it is not great, but 60% is higher than we had expected. We're just not sure about the quality or completeness of those gynecological exams. And then have you ever been tested for HIV? More than half say no in New York City and additional 5% say they don't know. That's a little bit better in LA County. 31% said no and 69% said yes. So the LA County study did couple their interview with an HIV test. We did ask them to not include that test in this question, but it's possible that some of them did include that. Did you ever test positive for HIV? In New York City, there were no yeses. 27% said they don't know. A small percentage said yes, and then a smaller percentage said don't know in LA County. Okay, so just to sum up a little bit, So I'll provide a brief summary and then just a few recommendations. So in sum, the work is highly exploitative, but perhaps not in the way that the general public might imagine. Massage parlor workers experience violence in their work. However, the storefront massage parlor context may be more benign than other types of sex work, such as street sex work, or even sex work that occurs in more clandestine areas, such as private apartments or houses. Many of the women describe themselves as free agents, able to easily leave and re-enter the work. The participants express more fear of the police than of managers and clients. And because of this, participants are reluctant to seek police help when they're targets of crime because of their illegal work and undocumented status. Stigma and social isolation may create barriers to seeking help. So it creates a lot of social isolation, which may exacerbate some of the issues that they face. There also may be significant health risks. So in New York City, the Asian population is the only racial group that has shown significant increases in HIV infection rates in the last few years. There are still, though, among Asian women in general, not just massage parlor workers, which we don't have real data for, but among Asian women in general, the absolute numbers of HIV infection are relatively low. However, a large number of women have not been tested for HIV. So just a little bit about recommendations. So one of the things we have been thinking about and propose is that we need to frame the massage parlor question away from sort of the kind of sensationalist view and focus more on it as a labor rights issue and as part of the larger immigrant survival story, not as sort of a separate piece, but really as part of that story, and in part to challenge stigma in the communities, and also a law enforcement reform issue. And so some specific recommendations are to modify police practices and court services to protect the safety and rights of massage parlor workers, to increase employment options, addressing structural issues such as immigration status, job training, education. That's a tall order, I know, it's easier said than done. Increasing health access to healthcare, prevention, education, and health screening, and working with key community institutions such as religious institutions to reduce the stigma of massage parlor work. For example, if we could raise awareness through some of these community institutions, there may be more acceptance and less judgment of this population, which would open up the situation, I think, for better access to healthcare, better access to jobs, better access to services that might help the women find other options for work. And just want to acknowledge the other principal investigator, Lois Takahashi, and then our research team. And then finally, if you want to download our full report again, here's the link. And if you have any questions, please feel free to contact me at this email address. So thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to present this research to you.
Well, Russell, do you have any questions? Maybe you asked first.
Yeah, I just had an observation because, when I was working in New York,
yeah,
I did was in charge of doing sort of an HIV, sexual transmission kind of campaign where we tried to get condoms into places that, wouldn't necessarily, we would actually distribute them to massage parlors, mm-hmm. karaoke places, internet cafes, and places like that. And what I was, I guess my observation is, yeah, thank you for your research, is that I think the issue also has to do with the larger immigrant community, because I had some experiences where I noticed that a lot of the clients are actually immigrants themselves. You know, whether they're documented or undocumented, it's hard to say. So, you know, there's a whole subculture of working people, especially whether it's you know, construction workers on their day off, cooks, whatever, people in the service industry that actually, I mean, well, they get a haircut and then they go get a massage, and it's just part of their routine. So it seems to me that, you know, even though it's stigmatized, yet it's very much part of the, at least the Chinese community. And then I have some colleagues who actually are into that. And one I know is a male and one is female. And with the COVID, they have actually asked, moved their business into their sort of apartments. You know, and I guess by referral and so forth. So I think that, you know, there is a whole, stigmatized or not, there is a whole subculture of sex workers and people who avail themselves of it. And, you know, and I think a lot of the clients, now you said a lot of the women you found were older women, like in their 40s. These were through the maybe the white reviews, right? What did you say? Rub map or something
Rub
like
maps,
that?
Yes.
But, you know, I mean, if you use the Chinese internet and so forth, you know, I think you'll probably find that there's maybe the older ones, when they were younger, they worked in other places. And then the younger females are, you know, on the Chinese internet with the photos and this and that. Yeah. It's a different crowd.
I should clarify that we didn't recruit the women through Rub Maps. We just documented the location of massage parlors through Rub Maps.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so the women were recruited through the Chinese and Korean ethnic press and also at the courthouses and also going directly to massage parlors.
A lot use WeChat and all those kind of apps now. I mean, they don't even go through the, you know, ethnic, you know, they're not going to put an ad in the Chinese paper.
Yeah. A lot of the women use WeChat in our study. Yes. I hear you around the community of massage parlor workers and their clients. But I do have to say the women in the study who are, you know, primarily monolingual Chinese and Korean speaking women, they were deathly afraid of having anybody find out about the work they're doing. I mean, their experience of the stigma was quite intense. So I do think between clients and the workers that, yeah, there is an understanding between them, but then outside of that environment, I think it's really difficult for the women to get any kind of acceptance or feel safe sharing what they do.
Yeah, and I think they also get exploited not just by clients, but by other people, say in their own ethnic community. One immigration, he's not a lawyer, but a like a helper who helps to facilitate immigration matters.
Yeah.
What he did was have a, you know, he had a whole line of women outside his store, and if they wanted a discount, they would have to, you know, basically sleep with him. And I thought that was pretty, I mean, I know this person, I thought it was a little bit disgusting, actually. Well, and so basically, there's this whole chain of exploitation, not only clients, but on, you know, different parts of the, you know, immigrant society.
Yeah, a lot of the women talked about feeling they were strung along by their immigration attorneys. So not even, you know, sexual exploitation, but just being promised things and then having to pay and then saying it's delayed and give me another $5,000 but nothing ever happens. So they're sort of being exploited at so many different levels.
In regards to decriminalization, has there been any updates? I mean, prior to COVID starting, what was sort of the push for it in terms of different advocacy groups?
Yeah, so there are a couple things happening. One is that the NYPD announced maybe 2 years ago that they're going to, you know, shift their focus away from arresting massage parlor workers and focusing on arresting clients and owners. So that actually did have an impact on the number of arrests. There are still raids happening, but it seems to have gone down after that declaration. And the other piece is that there is a push to decriminalize sex work in New York State. So that's sort of underway. Some assembly members are pushing that. I have to say, though, it is a very, very contentious debate, and the two sides are very, very entrenched. And so the people who are for decriminalization are very passionate about it. The people who are against it are very passionate about it as well. So nothing's happened yet on that legislation. And I think it's been derailed a bit because of COVID. And also because of COVID, you know, the massage parlor activity has just declined quite a bit. So it's not something we've really looked into, but I'm guessing that the women are in very difficult financial circumstances right now.
Sure. In terms of your study was from 2015 to 2016.
Yes.
Does your research group happen to want to follow up on sort of this post 2016, says this post election? I don't know if the economy had, and the government, you know, whoever was in place, current immigration laws have effect on sort of the type of workers or why they're going to this type of work in the first place?
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, we do want to do follow-up. So that's an interesting question, that in terms of change of presidential administration. But we also want to do a post-COVID follow-up to see how the industry overall has fared. Yeah, you know, I'm not sure because the human trafficking initiatives are very popular and sort of bipartisan, and so a lot of the activities against massage parlor workers or things that make their lives more difficult, I think they might be pretty robust under both types of administrations because they're falling under this sort of sex trafficking, human trafficking kind of initiative. I mean, I wonder if the Black Lives Matter movement might alter some of this also, because the women really complain very bitterly about police treatment. And so I think Black Lives Matter may be, you know, helping to spur changes that are, you know, overall changes that might affect their lives.
I think around this time last year is the anniversary of Song Yang's death in Flushing. Mm. The worker who jumped, you know, supposedly either jumped on purpose or was pushed, etc. And yeah. Then this year, due to COVID, you know, there's sort of no anniversary in order to remind people about what happened to her and also to bring about the issue of decriminalizing, you know, this particular field of work.
Hmm. Yeah, I think a lot of that media coverage was, you know, was partly responsible for these declarations from the NYPD about not arresting sex workers. Yeah. Yeah, there seems to be a bit of a turn, I think, in the public discourse around this. There's more support now for decriminalization, I think, than before.
Okay. Russell, any other questions?
Well, maybe there's some racism involved. I mean, one of Trump's colleagues, wasn't he arrested at some massage place in Florida? I mean,
the Florida case, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's easy to target because a lot of these massage places are, you know, do involve Asian women. I think it's an easy target, and both the Republicans and Democrats can be very self-righteous about whatever, whether it's criminalizing or decriminalizing, but it's one of those issues which make them appear more moral, I guess, to their wives and daughters and stuff, you know. Oh, yeah, this is something which, you know, it's these Asian women, besides diseases, there are these women and all this kind of thing. So, you know, I think there's a underlying, I would say, you know, it's not, maybe it's more implicit. I think there's some racism involved in this type of, you know, attention.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think you're right there. you know, a lot of the raids in Queens, people have talked about them being instigated by community complaints. And a lot of those community complaints are, they are racially tinged and sort of anti-immigrant. So they say, you know, look what the immigrants are bringing into our neighborhood and we don't like it. And
those particular raids, I mean, they cleaned up 40th Road for that particular section in Flushing. It no longer looks seedy, but then it's also very empty right now in terms of the other businesses that they cleared out. But then those particular older ladies that you refer to inside your report, you know, now they're sort of scattered about on Main Street, trying to lure people. Like once it hits like around 10 p.m. time, if you're walking there weekdays or weekends, you see just, you know, hang out on the corners now on Main Street instead of just 40th Road concentrated.
Right. So that's one thing is when law enforcement cracks down, people just move to other places. And then it does raise a question too. I mean, so if you're against the massage parlor work, what other options are you going to offer this group, right? To earn a living, to survive. So it's kind of easy to take a moral stance on this and to say, okay, let's crack down. But then what are the solutions then for the women?